Good evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. You know, periodically, I put aside the nuts and bolts of the law and instead focus on one of the legal movers and shakers who have helped to shape the legal landscape or changed our daily lives. Tonight on Your Legal Rights, I'm inviting you to join me in our virtual living room as we hold another such open house. Why are there laws? I mean, what are the laws there for? Social order? To protect people's personal rights or their property? Or so that you can rely on the government? No, laws are here to instill a sense of justice. And we live in a world where in the face of injustice, people look the other way or don't want to get involved. It's safer not to do anything or say anything because, after all, you weren't affected yourself. We console ourselves that the problems of others have nothing to do with us. They're none of our business, and we go home, glad at night that we were spared. Well, the maxim is, if you don't help bring about justice, then one day you too may experience injustice, and there'll be nobody out there to stand up for you. My guest tonight, a lawyer for some 44 years, exemplifies the axiom that the pen or the microphone is mightier than the sword. Paula Canny has practiced for most of that time out of San Mateo County with her brother Robert Canny, a former college football coach and an Arena League Super Bowl winning coach, now an attorney who practices alongside her. For years now, we've watched Paula's commentaries and interviews, whether chatting alongside Willie Brown or being interviewed, as she was earlier this week, by my frequent co-host Dean Johnson. Paula's never been one who stands by amidst injustice and then rants on a site such as Nextdoor, nor is she about relying on others to stand up for what's right or let them take on a cause. Whether in the courtroom or in front of the legislature, legislative bodies, or in the court of public opinion, it's been Paula who's always been the one to stand up to injustice or take on a cause in support of righting a social wrong. If you have questions about the career of this legendary attorney and activist, perhaps have a question about criminal law or one of the many issues Paula's taken on, and you'll hear about several of those tonight, feel free to give us a call. Our studio phone number here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. But do bear in mind our attorney guest can't provide you precise legal advice without all the facts relating to a given case, any more than a doctor would diagnose your child a few seconds into a phone call. But we're happy to pass along the legal principles to assist you in your decision-making. And remember, you can call with any question on tonight's topic. You want a question for Paula Canny? She's sitting right here. You want to ask about her legal career, her activism, or the many causes she supports? Feel free to call in. You don't have to jump in where we are in our conversation. And without further ado, I'm honored to say, Paula Canny, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Why, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me. I mean, that introduction was sort of surprising to me. I want to say 44 years. It's gone by in a nanosecond. It's my whole life has gone by so fast. And then at other times, you know, it just is so slow, like waiting for a jury is the slowest time in the world. Waiting for bar exam results was the slowest time in the world. But yeah, I've had an awesome career and I've gotten to help a ton of people. And that's actually why I wanted to be a lawyer.
And be clear, you have an awesome career. You're still at it, and I don't see you hanging it up anytime soon.
No, I mean, I am still at it. I still love what I do, and I still hate what I do, and I hate what I see, so it makes me do things, so I keep loving what I do. So, no, I'm going to work. I think I'm going to work for as long as I can work. I doubt seriously that all the social ills that I'm trying to address are going to somehow magically disappear. I wish that. My goal when I do criminal defense is to help the person and to figure out, you know, whatever it is that's brought them before the criminal justice system. And sometimes it's the fault of the criminal justice system. They literally have the wrong person. And other times they don't. I don't want repeat business. I want people to, most people who are defendants are victims. Victims victimize. Victims beget victims. And they have mental health issues. They have drug abuse issues. They have alcohol issues. They have mental health issues. They have situational problems. And so that's why I want to help those people so that they're not caught in the web of the criminal justice system. And then, you know, as I've done that longer over the course of my career, I realized there are definite systemic problems within the criminal justice system that I've tried really hard to address. Like even the matter, you know, we were talking that I have spent basically since 2017 trying to make sure that all women inmates have access to menstrual products. And that is a crazy thing that in 2017, that wasn't a thing. That in 2017, when I found out that San Mateo County charged $6.99 for a box of 10 tampons, I was like, how can that be? And so,
and again, we're talking about within the jail, people that can't go to the drugstore and buy for themselves, they can't take out their wallet because they don't have any money in the jail.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's a whole other issue that started over the last 10 years is the privatization of all of the things that go on within the county jails. I mean, to digress, there's 58 counties, there's 57 county jails, there's 57 different operational systems. And there are 57 different telephone systems, 57 different commissary systems, visiting systems. Each county jail is so difficult for the average person to navigate, and even for a lawyer to navigate. But right, you're right. People, and many of the people, more than 50% of the people in jails to this day are still pretrial detainees. And many of those, because we haven't outlawed cash bail here, though, although it's slightly improved over, say, 10 years ago, many of the people are in jail because they don't have the ability to post a bail, that is, pay money. So $6.99 in 2017 was double what you'd pay at Long's, you know, go have to pay. So, I mean, they were making a profit off people who have this necessity. And when I looked at this, each county had a different protocol. Each county had a different commissary list. San Francisco County was the only county that freely provided tampons and sanitary napkins without charge for women inmates. Some counties refuse to provide tampons, saying that, oh, the women might be mentally ill and might be too crazy and they might die of toxic shock. And my response to that was, if anybody is that mentally ill that they can't take care of themselves in that way,
why are they keeping them in jail?
Precisely. And that is a whole other thing that I've been working on over the last, you know, 10 years, trying to address what we do as a society with people who suffer from mental illness, because the state's jails are the 21st century mental hospitals, and that's just wrong morally, and it's wrong practically.
Well, it started as far back as 1970 with passing the Landerman-Petras
right.
Short Act, where the pendulum had gone too far the other way, where people were being warehoused, and clearly they had to clean that up. You can't have people drugged and warehoused in the mental hospitals. But the idea was to do it locally. The local setup never took place. No local entities were really designed to deal with it. And over the last 50 years, the jail population has been more and more overpopulated by people with mental health problems. You raised a whole plethora of issues that I want to go over with you, all related to the privatization of the criminal justice system. But before we do, let me turn it over to Peter from San Francisco. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I have a couple things that have to do with exclusion from service, one both in the private and public sector. I've always wondered when stores will have a thing, keep the right to refuse service to anyone, whether that's really true and whether they can just decide they don't want to serve you at the moment or even kind of 86 you. And the other thing is whether public service, like from some kind of an agency, a senior center, a library, or whatever, can decide on their own, basically, without really kind of a proper, I don't know what you'd call it, due process, that's kind of like a court thing where it's some independent agency deciding whether or not there's going to be service provided. And then a secondary thing is, more and more you go to restaurants and they won't show you a menu unless you, if you don't have a cell phone that can read the QR codes. And then there's the people that don't want to take cash, even though my dollar bill says this bill is legal tender for all debts, public and private. So there's all these various kinds of exclusions from public and private in various ways that I'm wondering if you can talk about what's just and what can be expected legally.
Okay, well, that's a lot. So the first thing is the law doesn't necessarily correlate to justice. We think it does. We want it that our laws are just, but just is a relative thing. And justice is sort of a normative concept. I mean, I have my view of justice. Other people have their view of justice. And the laws seemingly are society's view of what society believes is just. I'm not so sure that's true, because if you look at the foundation of our legal system, the reality of it is it's founded by it finds its genesis in the common law, which is England. England's government function started by kings. So if we evolve from kings to, some parliament, some democracy, but my point is, it was mostly white guys. And then as we've expanded, we have allowed, if you look at the history of the vote, if you look at the history of who can sit on juries, all that kind of things, gradually it's become more inclusive. So we've tried to sort of address like what justice is, but still the underpinnings of the legal system are, actually, I don't mean to sound so radical, but frankly are classist, racist, and sexist. And so we've adapted these things to try to improve the system to make it be more inclusive, but we still, I think, are impacted by its foundation. In terms of that, the idea about who won't take money, that makes me crazy too. I hate when I go to a store, and it started, during the pandemic, where they refused to take cash. Everything was done by cards. And so the cynical me thinks, oh, they want to do it so that they can better, track what we're doing. And that makes me crazy because I don't want my privacy invaded. So the only thing, I don't think that there is no law that compels somebody to take cash in lieu of a credit card. All that we can do is not shop at that place and hopefully find that by them not taking cash that they'll change their policy because they're missing our money.
Or you could buy the cards on sale at Safeway and use those, the generic visas that you prepay and the like. The problem is that if somebody gets a hold of that number and cracks the code, they go in and take the money out before you spend it.
Well, that too. I mean, that's a good – I love that you've thought of that like solution. I haven't thought of the solution like that. I'm just mad when they don't take cash, and I'm like, all right, I'm not going to shop there. And in terms of the restaurants and the QR codes, that's frustrating too. I actually now have asked them, oh, hey, even if I can get the QR code on my phone, I ask for a paper menu. I just, you know, I don't want to kill a tree, but it's super hard for me to read it off the phone when I could. It's just easier off a piece of paper. But
Most of the restaurants that I go to, if they had the QR codes during the pandemic, they may have left them up, but they still offer menus. There aren't many that I see where they won't provide a menu if you ask. Peter, one thing else you brought up is where you have in the private sector where people have signs, such as at a restaurant or a takeout, that says, we reserve the right to refuse service to anybody. Well, it's not clear that they had that right. And to a certain extent, that sign is a big bluff.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you can't refuse to leave. You can't refuse to leave and disrupt them from being able to move on to the next customer or conduct business. That could get you arrested, and I don't want to sound like that's the case. But they may be speaking where they don't really have that right, and there may be action. And even in the areas where the law provides somebody the right to distinguish amongst customers, not necessarily to discriminate amongst customers. And while it sounds like I'm talking in circles, the reality is where you're allowed to say yes to one and not to another, it has to be for a good reason. At least it can't be for the wrong reason.
Well, it has to be for a legal reason, because a lot of people think their reasons are good and they're flat out just illegal. But even that is super confusing. And that, because it's like, legally, let's think back to, you know, I don't even know how many years before 1954, schools could say, we refuse the right, we won't let black kids go to school here. We won't let, black people eat at this luncheon counter and all that stuff, which was legal then. That was legal. That's what I'm saying. To me, that is never just. It's always morally wrong. But hey, the law said it could do it. I mean, it's interesting. We're on Juneteenth right now, and the end of slavery is because a law was changed. And the insane thing was that was ever legal to me. And it was, and the United States had, you know, a civil war over it. But I'm saying, if you look at some of the things that the law has made legal, it's unbelievable. We could make laws that say no kid should ever go hungry, but we don't have that law. You know, and again, I think that's because of our foundation and, you know, resource allocation, money and the like. And I agree with Jeff. I think we refuse the right, or we reserve the right to serve anybody, is more a bluff. But then that whole Supreme Court thing about the cake with the gay couple, that baker doesn't have to bake a cake for a gay couple, and that's legal. And that's also crazy. I mean, who cares? Just bake the cake.
I had heard, mm-hmm. true or not, they weren't even looking to refuse service to a gay couple. They were looking to set up a case. And the history behind it has nothing to do with what really occurred.
Well, right. And that's often how, you know, cases come up. The sort of backstory of a case is different, or the media story of a case is different than the reality of a case. And there have absolutely been, you know, set up cases to try and make a point using the judicial system to make a case decision, which is in reality a political point. So it's super complicated. So
generally, though, take it for granted that the public sector mm-hmm. will move faster, because you can apply the Constitution to the publics, that is to the government sector, faster than the private sector. The one area that might not follow that pattern is actual discrimination, racial discrimination, because since that all stems from the 13th Amendment and the beginning of the abolition of slavery and equal rights, that's been applied to the private sector as well. But for the most part, you can make the government move on this faster because you have the Constitution behind them in a way that it might not as
right. And then at the same time, you can also have a government refusing to move even when there's been a judicial decision. I mean, all you have to do is look at the 1960s. And there were, you know, states in the South that adamantly did everything they possibly could to, you know, obstruct school integration, school desegregation. And even that word, you know, the use of the term integration as opposed to desegregation, same thing in a way, and then not at all, because desegregation has to acknowledge that we had segregated schools for, you know, decades and decades and decades, and that was legal. And many people thought those laws were just. I don't. You know, I didn't. And now as we come forward, it's clearly inhumane, wrong, immoral, all those things. But that's what I'm saying. Laws are something that we really need to look at and see what it's doing and, you know, try to fight the injustice of a law like that. And there's still plenty of injustice done.
The law, the legal system, the Constitution is like your car where the steering's a little loose. You've got to constantly adjust to keep going on the line you want to be on, because as people awaken, as morals change over time, we want to preserve what we have. We want to get rid of the injustices. We want everybody to share in this great nation we have, the great rights we have. Peter, thank you for joining us. I hope you've enjoyed it. We've enjoyed having you with us.
Thank you.
And let me turn it to Donald from San Carlos. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, yes. I'd like to ask your guest to give an assessment of the jury pools that she is seeing as far as it comes to race, class, and gender, and whether or not she thinks the jury usually gets it right.
And let me add to that. Donald, you brought up a very good point, and while we're on that subject, I'd like to add one more element. Paula, you have practiced law in virtually every county of this state. I don't know how many of those counties you've seen juries, but if you see that a jury pool changes so differently from one county to another, is that a factor in your answering the other part of his question?
So That's complicated. There are 58 counties. For example, Alpine County is the one county that in the state of California that doesn't have a county jail. They outsource their jail to El Dorado County. It's a huge county geographically, but I think it has under 10,000 people in it. They have one tiny little courthouse. They routinely can't get a jury pool. It's so spread out. There are so few people in the county. So for them to have a jury pool is a challenge for that jury commissioner. In terms of, to answer your question in San Mateo, that's interesting. I just tried a case in February and picked a jury over the course of a week. And I was amazed at how different the jury pool was than when I started. When I started in San Mateo County, it was mostly white people and black people. And it was mostly white people. And then over time, I mean, the demographics of San Mateo has changed drastically. I mean, in East Palo Alto, when I first started, you know, there was like, well, great barbecue. And now there's no barbecue and it's, you know, a lot of taquerias. That is just how it is that's changed. And in some ways, I mean, I will digress for a sec to say that in many ways, those areas were super law enforcement focused, the same around the King Center in San Mateo County. So if you look at the demographics of San Mateo, the African American population is much lower now as a percentage of the population than it was 40 years ago. And so that's surprising, but that's, I think, what happens when you prosecute, focus on particular race, where a particular race lives. I mean, that's just what happened. In terms of now, though, it was interesting because it was a mishmash of people. It was like people 101. There, it was super interesting because there were people, there were white people, black people, though very few, lots of people from the Philippines, China, Japan, Malaysia, Indonesia, Mexico. It was a super interesting cross-section of people. So my most recent jury panel, I was amazed at how diverse the panel was. It was impressive in a good and sweet way.
One of the things I've noticed when I started my practice in San Mateo County in the mid-90s, there was a population that was showing up in prosecutions that wasn't so much showing up with social services. And it seemed that San Mateo County, through at least the 1990 census, was largely piggybacking on the larger counties that surround it and didn't understand or wasn't institutionally aware that they have a much larger representation of Pacific Islanders within the county.
Totally.
And we would see people of Samoan descent, of Tongan descent, that were getting prosecuted. But not only weren't they showing up on our juries, but they weren't getting mental health services that were geared to that culture. They weren't getting really any services to speak of from social services. And I had a case that brought a lot of that to light in about 2000.
I mean, that's true. I mean, that's a really good point. But I mean, again, we have to sort of, how we ended up here now requires looking back at what we did then. And so the area around the Martin Luther King Center had a large African-American population. And then west of El Camino Real had virtually no African-American, no black people whatsoever, because up until the mid-60s, everything sort of west of El Camino Real in the city in San Mateo had all these race-restrictive covenants. So the deed said you couldn't sell to somebody who wasn't a white person. And that's crazy. That's like
it was in the CCNRs, which means you as an owner weren't free to sell to someone like that. And
well,
I remember growing up, Willie Mays tried
yeah.
to move into Hillsborough.
Right.
No, not even condos, houses. And even Willie Mays was refused the opportunity to move to Hillsborough.
Right. That's insane, okay, that in our lifetime that was ever a thing. And I'm grateful that it's, like, not a thing, but I think we always have to recognize that it was, and it still impacts us to this day.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we're holding an open house with attorney, activist, commentator Paula Canny. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any questions for my guest and for me. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in the conversation. You're listening to Your Legal Rights, and we'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You know, I was going to go a completely different direction tonight, but just the course of the conversation has brought up such interesting stuff. One of the things that you mentioned was the privatization of so many facets in the criminal justice system. And in most places outside of San Francisco, the mental health system. In San Mateo County, by way of example, there's a fairly small mental health component. The actual providers are mostly privatized. You go to the jail, and yes, there's inmates making food, but most people rely heavily on commissary, which is privatized, and they're buying their stuff. The phones are a story in and of itself. You can't accept a call from the jail unless you've already prepaid a lot of money so that you could receive the calls, not just the call in general, and if in that call in specific. And if that person is calling you, collect, and you don't have that account set up, they show you how to do it, but as you're doing it, that person's call gets cut off. What do you think of all this?
Well, it's complicated. So I think there's actually legislation regarding the cost of jail calls, because a couple years ago, it was $3 a minute. It was so cost prohibitive.
And the people that provide that provided free of cost to the jail, not only the phone systems that people can use, but the ability to record the calls and use it against them in the prosecution. And that was part of the contract, is that they would provide that service and basically be given the ability to rip the people off who are receiving the phone calls.
Well, that's true, but I'm saying the thing with phone calls, because every solution, especially when it comes to the criminal justice system, you know, shows that there's a problem. So a couple, 10, 15 years ago, it was $3 a minute, $3 a minute. I mean, it was so expensive. People were going broke just trying to talk to their loved ones. But now what's happened with all the cell services and also with regulation, it's drastically different. I think now if you're calling from prison, there aren't charges to the family when it's from prison. When it's county jail, it varies from county to county. So let's talk about that. So San Mateo County instituted a privatized phone system. They use, I think it's GlobalTel for the telephone. But San Mateo, during the pandemic, instituted this thing called the Smart Communication System. It allows inmates to communicate with their loved ones on tablets. It allows them to send text messages and emails on these tablets. It allows them to visit by, you know, video on these tablets. And so it costs 50 cents to send a text. They count these things. You do it credits. And so the thing that people think, oh, that's so much cheaper. But what's happened with Smart Mail is it is a complete invasion of privacy. The guards can sit and read your emails, your text messages. Any person in law enforcement can look at any single thing anybody wants regarding any inmate. It is a private company. The county doesn't have to pay anything. All the money is earned by this corporation. So inmates pay, inmates' families pay. And the interesting thing about this particular business is when the family of the inmate signs up, like I want to talk to my friend, I sign up, I give them my name, my address, my cell phone number, and a credit card number. That company sells that information to a third party and has another revenue source by selling my private information. That goal of that company is to be the largest data gatherer of inmate communication in the world. And that is so unbelievable. San Mateo County in the jail has eliminated paper mail. If you want to send a letter to a loved one, you have to mail it to Florida. Somebody at Smart Mail in Florida scans it into their system, and then it is submitted electronically to the inmate on that message tablet. Now, that isn't that to receive it, it's free, but to respond by the tablet is 50 cents. I mean, the owner of that company, Smart Mail, is so rich now. It's so, well, I won't even get started on how they didn't vet who the owner of the company is, but it is a convicted felon who came up with that idea when he was serving time for stalking. And that's who inmates' families' private information is, you know, going to, and that's who's privy to it, and that's who's selling it. So, yeah.
Let's take it a step further.
Mm-hmm.
You've talked about changes in the way that people receive mail.
Mm-hmm.
And how somebody found a way to profit from it at the expense of the – typically it comes off the inmate's books, which means their families and things that are trying to give them money
right.
to buy commissary or toiletries or the like are going to have to pay mm-hmm. for it. But other things that have changed of late, it used to be that if you wanted to visit an inmate, you would go down and visit an inmate mm-hmm. once or twice. Many jails in the state are moving towards video visits and saying you can't go in and see them. You can't visit them face-to-face even behind this plexiglass. You have to go into a room with a bunch of computers and other people.
Right.
You can't do it online from outside. You have to do it inside so we can monitor it. And you go in this big room with a bunch of other people doing the same thing.
Right. I mean, it is surreal. I mean – during the pandemic, it maybe offered a solution. Maybe it decreased the possibility of people getting sick from being around one another and the like. So maybe that was a reasonable solution given everybody's fear. But no, I mean, even San Mateo, who installed, has this room in the front part of their new Maple Street jail that is filled with these terminals, video terminals, and wanted people to go in there and sit them at them. They figured out, no, this was not good for people's mental health and have reinstated allowing visits. But those visits are behind glass. And, you know, that is just sort of problematic. And what we were saying is that one of the reasons that that's doable is we incarcerate so many people in the state of California and in the United States. The U.S. incarcerates more people than any other country, both relatively and absolutely. I mean, that's a crazy fact. There aren't more bad Americans than other countries. Okay, but that's what we do because there is a financial premium on incarcerating people. The other thing that is so interesting about what's different than 50 years ago is jail architecture. You know, it used to be like Cool Hand Luke got to go outside and, you know, break rocks. Most inmates never go outside.
You know, a good example of this is to take a look at Santa Clara County.
Right.
In Santa Clara County, there was a more traditional jail built at Milpitas. You go out and see people face to face. You actually mix
right.
it up with incarcerated folks while you walk to where you're supposed to meet
mm-hmm.
the person. And it's much more prison-like than jail-like, but people are treated like human beings, at least to the extent that you can see them.
What?
And by comparison, they have a main jail downtown where it's very compartmentalized. You stand in an elevator with no buttons and hold up however many fingers on your hand so the operator who's looking knows you're coming in from outside and that's the floor to send you to. You go to an area where people are completely isolated from everybody else and people are all compartmentalized in very small groups in an isolated area. They never get outside.
Well, that's true, but I mean, how jails are run is regulated by the government. There's Title 15, and that sets how jails can be constructed, there's a different title that deals with jail construction. My point is, yes, that's a good point, except I'd rather go to Santa Clara County, because even though you hold your fingers up to get to the floor, you get to have face-to-face contact with your client, and it isn't so difficult as to get a face-to-face meeting. I like breathing the same air. I like looking at them, not being separated by glass. I think there's better privacy, you know. I think my point about the thing is that it's cheaper to build jails where people are contained. And that there's the whole thing about the impact of solitary confinement and not getting outside. But my point is, we all need sunlight. Every inmate, and I'm sure pretty much every jail in the state of California, has a vitamin D deficiency. And even in terms of food, you can't get a fresh vegetable. I mean, you don't get – the commissaries only sell junk food. It's just not a healthy way to live for anybody. I mean, I think for me, the hardest part, if I had to go to jail, would be not getting outside. I think in terms of changing people and people being impacted, one of the things that helps people the most is to be outside, to breathe fresh air, to have grass under one's feet. It just connects people, and it helps us to be people.
And I want to jump in with two quick points.
Mm-hmm.
The first is, we've mentioned San Mateo and Santa Clara counties, tangentially San Francisco. But as Bay Area lawyers, this is where we go. We're not suggesting they're any worse than anywhere else.
Oh, no,
and
totally.
There's a lot of places worse than what we got here.
Oh, I mean, totally, totally, totally. And my experience with everybody in the Bay Area is that everybody tries really hard to make the system be better, people's lives be better. I'm not saying, oh, people don't care. Everybody I work with cares a lot. I don't know. I want to believe that's true every place in California, but I've been to jails all over, and yeah, jails are jails. Bad stuff can happen in jails. I've been, you know, we talked about before, I did that case in San Luis Obispo where a mentally ill man had been held in solitary confinement for 3 months. His poor parents thought he was being well cared for, and he'd just been locked in a cell that the guards controlled, whether the toilets flushed, whether he got water. And he eventually started to hit himself in the head, thinking, oh, maybe I'll get out of this room. And then they come in with hazmat suits, put him in a restraint chair where he spent 46 and a half hours in a restraint chair. Sure, they'd come in and move his arm, but he was naked. He urinated on himself, defecated on himself, and then give him little bits of water. He didn't really get any food. And 46 and a half hours later, they let him out of that restraint chair. And then he writhed around, and I watched the videos from the two camera angles. I had to go to therapy after watching all those things. He writhed around, and he died of a pulmonary embolism. So bad stuff can happen in jails in any place, anywhere, and it's especially bad when mentally ill people are incarcerated, because overall, correctional staff aren't trained to deal with people suffering from a major mental illness. And that's just the reality. So if we want to have a good change, we need to address the fact that the criminal justice system isn't the place to treat mentally ill people. This is a public health problem, not a criminal justice system problem.
The other problem that I see, and the other point I wanted mm-hmm. to make, is that one thing that is finally starting to change, I don't believe it has changed. It is changing broadly enough or rapidly enough. But traditionally, jails are solely interested in separating people away from us as a punishment, mm-hmm. keeping them locked up, providing a meager way of life, something that nobody would aspire towards, as a punishment. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever did so with the vision, or at least mm-hmm. until recently, that these people are going to be getting out, some sooner, some later. But if what you do seriously damages people, they're going to be walking the streets, and you put it in motion.
Well, that's totally right. I mean, the reality is most people who are incarcerated are going to be released from that place of imprisonment. I mean, San Mateo County, San Francisco County, all of the Bay Area counties in one way or another have instituted programs to try and help people. San Mateo has a really good program where they have cooking classes to try and teach people how to be chefs and stuff. But who has access to that class is severely limited. It can't be any violence. It can't, you know, so it's limited who has access to these things. You know, for a while, San Mateo had that canine program where they had the inmates working with the dogs. I mean, the most successful program in regarding lack of recidivism was back in the day when there was the California Youth Authority. There was a girls in the Girls Youth Authority program. They had a dog grooming and dog care class, and that the people that participated in the dog grooming and, you know, vet tech class had the lowest recidivism rate of any program in the state of California. I mean, now the youth authority is essentially closed, but I mean, I think helping others helps people to be a good person. And so whether it's helping an animal or helping another inmate, I think that that's just a truism. And so your point about, yes, jails they go back in, and then we can even talk about 1170H to get rid of, you know, prison overcrowding, the
and
jail.
And for those that are listening, 1170H, we referred to as lawyers, you may have called it realignment.
Right.
And the idea is to shift low-level felonies to the counties rather than state prison.
Right. And so it should have been this good thing, but the money to help the counties provide programs hasn't been forthcoming. I mean,
it became an unfunded mandate.
Precisely.
And the people who paid the price
are the inmates and the families of loved ones and potential, you know, crime, people who are hurt or victimized by people who don't get rehabilitated. No, we haven't done a very good job.
Well, in that regard, have we done anything more than just kicking the can down the road?
I mean,
we've seen a lot of jails get built.
We've seen a lot of jails get built. That's true. No, I think really it starts with, if we think about, the reality is most people in jail are poor. So there's an economic component to that. I mean, people who, 25% of the children in the state of California don't have enough food. How is that a thing? There's plenty of food. We have a distribution problem of resources. No kid should ever go hungry. But I'm pretty sure that being a hungry kid in a world of affluence doesn't make for a happy kid or a well-adjusted student. Everybody should have enough to eat, a safe place to live and sleep, and get to have a nice life. So,
and we don't want the things that we do as citizens, that means the government does, to interfere with people's ability to, for way of example, we want them working with us. We want them working for us. We shouldn't be not only excessively incarcerating or punishing people, but the reality is when we do that, we're also paying for them. We're providing all of their support. They're not contributing to society as all. They're not contributing to us. Mm-hmm. And we're providing the cost of all the meals, all the housing, all the facilities. Somewhere the system has to adapt?
Well, going back again to this notion of with how much drug addiction and mental illness there is impacting the criminal justice system, if we re-examine how we look at the problem and treat it as a public health crisis, that requires building hospitals and providing health care providers, therapists, and the like. And I'm afraid that as a system, it's cheaper to maintain the status quo than to build the necessary facilities to help people. So
we don't have a lot of time left. Mm-hmm. One thing that I did want to chat with you about mm-hmm. is you're not as busy with the criminal justice system directly these days. You're not doing the criminal defense as often.
I mean, that's true.
What kind of stuff are you working on?
Well,
I know you haven't slowed down.
No, I'm still super busy. I mean, in terms of criminal defense, the cases I have right now are just super heavy and time-consuming. And one of the most impactful things about anybody that's doing any sort of litigation is how much the cell phone has impacted and electronic media has impacted everything. A simple case now has a bunch of body-worn cameras that you have to look at. It's way more time-consuming now than it is to just read a police report. The information of it's better, but even on police officers wearing body-worn cameras, they turn them on, they turn them off. There's a certain amount of stuff. But no, in terms, I'm still working on getting access to menstrual products for women inmates. I'm sort of stuck in Georgia. Georgia has over 250 counties, and some of the counties charge $3 for one tampon. I've spoken to a sheriff back there, and I was like, how can you charge $3 for one tampon? Everybody in your jail's poor. And he's like, oh, we're not so politically correct as you in California. I'm like, is toilet paper a political issue? I'm like, come on, that's just not right. So I'm still doing that. And I'm also looking at, you know, that same thing as it relates to schools, kids in poor schools. You know, do they have access to menstrual products? Because what I've found out is that in poor schools, girls don't go to school when they have their period if they don't have somehow access to menstrual products. So we're all judgmental here about how in India or Nepal, the girls go and hide off in some little shed for 5 days. Essentially, if a kid doesn't have access to a menstrual product, that is the functional equivalent. She just stays home. So we need to do that everywhere so that every little girl doesn't ever have to worry about not having a menstrual product so that she can go about her life. I think that's a reasonable thing that we should all hope for. So it isn't just in jails, it's in schools, it's, you know, everywhere.
We have another caller on the line. We have just a couple minutes. We're really short, but Alyssa, you're on the air.
Thanks. I've been a criminal defense attorney since 1987 doing, you know, adult and juvenile cases. Mm-hmm. What you're saying about the adult world and the changes is so spot on. The juveniles incarcerated mm-hmm. in these juvenile halls with nothing to do, no
right.
programs, you know, no funding. You know, that's the issue, is no funding anymore.
Totally.
Well, that's part of it, and part of it with the reduction in the dark side of reducing the population is that there's less staffing. There was a while in one nearby county, I'm not going to mention it, where they were getting leftovers from the jail brought up
yeah.
to use that to feed the kids in the hall.
Well, I mean, what you're saying, I get it. And here in the Bay Area, it's bad, but if you go to the outlying counties, if you go to Del Norte County, if you go to Shasta County, I mean, there are all these kids that are both delinquent, that is, kids that are accused of doing bad stuff, and then dependent, kids who don't have parents that can take care of them. They're basically double winners, and like in Del Norte, they've essentially closed their juvenile hall, and their kids are shipped to Shasta County. Yep. That's like 4 hours. How can a parent see their kid 4 hours away? It's because
the parents know better. The parent doesn't have a clue. That's the problem.
Well, it isn't. But the court, they don't have a... partly parents. What if the kid doesn't have anybody to separate a kid that far from their community?
Yeah.
Schooling?
And sometimes for the most ridiculously minuscule...
Totally.
The first case that I took on when I moved my practice back to the Bay Area... The first juvenile case I had was a kid who was locked up in custody. He had been already there a day and a half when I got to him. No record, and he had taken a sandwich from the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
And because the family moved the day before, and the officer refused to let him direct him to his house, he had just moved and didn't have the address, no phone set up yet, and they had him locked up.
Yeah, no, that's crazy, but
saying. And the probation officer yelled at me for having to go and investigate the house that I found.
Right.
And that was routine.
Yeah.
Some places still is.
It's beyond, everything is sort of beyond these days.
It's a really hard way to make a living.
I love it, but lack of mental health care, you know, that's the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many issues. I remember San Francisco jail where you could just go into the jail and just meet with the person in a little room.
Well, you can still do that at 850 Bryant Street.
Yeah.
It's a little more
can.
Problematic at the jail in San Bruno. But it's a great way to help people, and it's a great way to drive myself crazy and. You know,
you have to love what you do and hate what you do. You hate because you can't erase the things we've seen.
Yeah. No, there's definitely a phenomenon of secondary trauma. It absolutely is real. I mean, we are.
I don't think I have trauma. You know, that doesn't give me trauma. It pisses me off.
Okay.
It doesn't traumatize me. I, you know.
Well, different things.
At least so far as you're aware.
No, I definitely have.
I'm almost old enough not to care.
But if you've seen some of the stuff that the system causes us to see.
Oh, yeah.
You will have secondary trauma. You may not be aware of it, but there are times when you stop something you're about to do, or you grab somebody who's going to the water cooler and say no, or... any one of a number of things where you've adapted your behavior because of what you've seen without even realizing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but just talking and listening to you talk is cathartic, you know, because it really...
Right, it's important.
It's important what I do, you know.
What you do is important. What all of us do is important.
Yeah,
but the reality is what every single one of us does is important, whether you're a crossing guard or a lawyer or a judge.
Oh, sure.
I hate to cut everybody off.
I would love to sit here with both of you, but unfortunately we're out of time and I have to cut us off.
Okay.
You've been listening. And Alyssa, join us again. I would love to chat with you. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we've had an open chat with a local legend within the legal and political communities. My guest tonight has been attorney activist Paula Canny. Please come back to Your Legal Rights next week, where, as always, we will take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to tonight's guest, Paula Canny, and to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe, have a good night, and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.